two very different memoirs on the podcast this week. How much can a single novel influence an individual's life? Rebecca Mead is here to talk about My Life in Middlemarch.
Having, you know, reached my 40s, I wanted to go back and look at it and think about why it had made such an impact on my life and why it still continued to mean so much to me.
Will this interview make Scott Stossel anxious? The author joins us to talk about his new memoir, My Age of Anxiety.
I have not taken additional special measures as I might if this were, you know, in front of an auditorium of 5,000 people who were looking at me or live TV or something like that.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Rebecca Mead's new book, My Life in Middlemarch, is reviewed this week on the cover by Joyce Carol Oates. Rebecca joins us now. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
So you and I share a love of Middlemarch, but for those who have not read it three times, why Middlemarch?
Well, I first read Middlemarch when I was 17 and was completely seized by it and loved it. And I've read it about every 5 years since then. And as I have grown older, I've seen different things in it. And I feel as if I've grown up and the book has grown up with me, or I've grown up with the book. Having, you know, reached my 40s, I wanted to go back and look at it and think about it and think about why it had made such an impact on my life and why it still continued to mean so much to me.
You know, it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about this idea of rereading and the way that you look at a book differently depending on the stage you are in life. So, you know, you can read Anna Karenina when you're, you know, young and romantic in your 20s and you think like, oh my God, this is such an amazing affair. And then you read it when you're just married and you think, this is terrible. Look at what she's destroying her family. And then I'm sure at some point you read it and you think, wow, wouldn't that be kind of nice when you're, you know, you've been married for 30 years. So I'm curious as to how reading Middlemarch now at this stage in your life, how it felt different from when you read it as a 17-year-old.
Yeah, well, when I read it when I was 17, I thought it was all about the trials of young love because that's what I was concerned with.
Right, and then Dorothea entering and making a terrible mistake
exactly,
in her marriage.
Exactly. And then, you know, reading it in my 20s, I thought a lot about what it said about what marriage should be or shouldn't be. You know, I didn't get married until I was in my 30s, but I was thinking about it in my 20s and trying to figure out what I was looking for. When I read it in my 30s, when I was already established as a writer and trying to be taken seriously as one, I the story of Tertius Lydgate, who's the doctor who has great aspirations to make medical breakthroughs
right.
and then ends up being a specialist in gout, a rich people's disease, you know, spoke to me very profoundly and kind of in a kind of a warning there.
And please then, tell me you never identified with Casaubon.
Well, you know, I do think that, you know, when you read it when you're young, you see Casaubon and you just think, oh, he's so awful and he's doing these terrible things to Dorothea and she's making this awful mistake. And, you know, now I'm the age that Casaubon is. And I feel that it would be really arrogant and sort of self-important and self-deluding to look at him and not recognize that what happens to him happens in some measure to all of us. You know, mm-hmm. that question of, well, have we done what we wanted to do? You know,
right.
are we being judged? You know, do we have the inner resources to love somebody properly or to do our work well or all those things? And he's so tortured. And I think that George Eliot, certainly she felt, you know, that there was a piece of Casaubon in her or a piece of
right.
her in Casaubon. I read him now with much more compassion, as I think she wrote him.
For listeners who are not familiar with this sort of central story of Dorothy and Casaubon, can you just tell us a little bit about who they are and the key to all mysteries? And
The key to all mythology.
The key to all mythology.
Yes. Dorothea is a young gentlewoman at the beginning of the novel who is as yet unmarried and yearning for a more significant life. And Edward Casaubon is the reverend who she believes to be a great scholar and marries in the hope that she is going to be sort of the handmaiden to his great works
mm-hmm.
and then discovers that what he already sort of knows about himself, which is that he has not come up with a theory to end all theories and that he's toiling away in obscurity and darkness and wasting his life.
And what does that mean for the marriage?
She has to ask herself whether she's going to submit, and she has to find within herself sympathy for him. And I think that that's what the novel in so many ways is asking of all its characters, and also asking of us as readers to enter into the perspectives and the experience and have sympathy with the, with all of these different characters who in their own ways are all flawed and frail. And George Eliot does this with great skill by moving from one perspective to another perspective and showing us that the world looks different depending on who you are, and your, and that everybody is standing at the center of their own experience, and it's incumbent upon us to try to step out of our own self-centeredness and to understand that everybody else feels that they're the center of their life too.
Right. The subtitle of Middlemarch is a study of provincial life, and it, you know, it feeds into this idea that I have that the authors of these huge 19th century novels, in a way, kind of tried to scare off perhaps readers from reading them. It's like War and Peace, which, you know, to the uninitiated looks incredibly daunting. And then, of course, you get into it and it's this fabulous sort of soap opera. But what do you make of the subtitle of the book? Because we're talking about all the human drama, but there's that great middle section, of course, where it's very much about Middlemarch.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's set in a provincial town in England, and it is tells the story, the interweaving stories of many characters from this provincial town. And we do have subplots about politics and farming and all kinds of things.
Yes.
But I think the provinciality of it is as much, you know, a provinciality of the soul as it is of the place. And I think it's possible to be provincial, even in one's mind, in a big city or a cosmopolitan place. I think that, again, it's this theme of being bound up with one's own concerns and one's own obsessions, and not seeing beyond into a broader horizon. In terms of the sort of the daunting size of Middlemarch, what is easy to forget is that this book was published over about 13 months in 8 shortish novella-length sections. And so when it first came out, it was absolutely the talk of the town, and people were dying to get the next installment.
And it was Dickens and people waiting on the docks.
Exactly. And yeah. So people were hungry for it. And readers are sometimes afraid of tackling a big book because they think it's going to be serious or hard or intimidating. And, you know, if you think of this as 8 short books, that's one easier way to approach it.
Did you find that in that, and I can't remember exactly, I think of it as part of the vast middle section where it is really about the politics of the town and about the agrarian side of life. Did you find your rereading of those sections changed over time?
Well, I mean, I'm from a provincial town in England, and so there's much about that world. I mean, not that we were, you know, we weren't farmers and so on, but I come from a small place that has that, you know, very limited kind of cultural world. And it seems to me in many ways not to have changed very much at all. When I was a child, the copy of Middlemarch I had a picture on the cover of it of a, it's in the Tate Gallery, and there's a woman climbing over a stile up a hillside. It looks exactly like a hill that is 5 minutes from where I grew up and where I was dying to get away from when I was a kid. So,
so you just come home when you're reading the book.
I do. I mean, it takes me back to England, and it takes me back to my own youth and my own readings of it throughout these different ages. And as I go back to it, I find different stories in it matter more to me than they did in the past. I mean, these days, when I read it, I'm very affected by the story of Mary Garth and Fred Vincey, who are the couple who have been in love since childhood. But there's a question about whether Fred's going to be a good enough man to earn Mary's love. And she's a very sensible, very kind of wholesome, clever girl who, when I was a young reader, I had very little interest in. But now when I read it, I see it in the light of my parents, who met when they were 14 and married when they were 21.
Wow.
Were married for 60 years. I look at that accomplishment of long-lived love with such awe and respect, because for all the adventures that I've had and the loves that I've experienced, I'll never have 60 years with anybody.
Right. One thing, though, even though, again, as you say, this is very much 19th century England, that runs through your book is just how modern the story is and how modern it feels. What makes this such a sort of contemporary, resonant kind of book?
People don't change. So the emotions that we feel, the anxieties we feel about, you know, what we're going to do with our lives, you know, have we accomplished what we wanted to accomplish? You know, does this person love us? Does this other person love us? You know, those things don't change very much. And so the context is obviously an English provincial town from the 1830s. It's a long time ago and far away. But I feel as if George Eliot makes Middlemarches of us all. You know, we're all living in her construction. And she builds this town and the interlocking psychological relationships of people. That's all instantly recognizable.
One of the admirable things about George Eliot is that her books are so very different. I mean, the other major novel I think of is by Eliot is Daniel Deronda, which also feels so contemporary. And I think it was one of the first novels to really talk about the Jews in England. Did you reread her other books alongside Middlemarch when you were working on this?
Yeah, I reread all of them and in some cases read them for the first time, like Romola. The one that spoke to me the most in writing this book, other than Middlemarch, was The Mill on the Floss, which I had not read for decades, and which is in some ways George Eliot's most autobiographical story. I found that the emotional connection that she describes in that book to a place and to a culture and to a history was so strong. And as I was writing my book, you know, I was in New York for most of the time, you know, thinking about where I had come from and where I had grown up. And it brought me back to sort of the lost physical landscape of my youth as well.
To the uninitiated, if you had to give a reason to read Middlemarch or to reread it, what would be your elevator pitch for that book?
It's great.
Yes.
It is funny, which you might not expect by seeing its, you know, daunting length on the shelf. It is infinitely wise. It is so intelligent. The authorial voice has a generosity and a sympathy that is unlike anything else I can think of. You just sort of sink into it and find things that you don't know about yourself, things that you don't know about the world are being reflected in this novel. It's just a, yeah, just go out and read it. It is so good.
Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Rebecca Mead. Her book, My Life in Middlemarch, is reviewed this week on the cover by Joyce Carol Oates. Julie Bosman joins us now. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So what's new in the publishing world?
There was an interesting book deal this week. Touchstone, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, bought a book that has been circulating for the last few days. It's a book that was based on a parody Twitter account at GS Elevator, and this is well known to people who follow it. There are more than 600,000 followers, and it's a Twitter account that purports to be made up of overheard snippets in the elevators at Goldman Sachs. So you can imagine just how profane and offensive and racist and sexist and classist all of these things are, because who knows if they're actually true, but they're allegedly things that bankers say to each other when they're in the privacy of the company elevator.
Okay, completely fascinating. There's like a number of Twitter accounts like that, like Condé Nast Cafeteria, but I guess people really want to know what the wolves of Wall Street actually say behind closed elevator doors.
Exactly. And I think that this account, which started in 2011, if I'm not mistaken, sprung from the Condé elevator account, which I think was closed down pretty quickly, actually. But it was a moment in Twitter history when elevator accounts sprung up. But this one keeps going. The owner of the account, who has been anonymous and remains anonymous, was and perhaps still is an employee at Goldman.
Until you reveal the identity, Julie Bosman, reporter extraordinaire.
If only. I have no idea who he is, although we did exchange emails this week talking about his book deal. And he said that he had the idea for the book long before he started tweeting, that he's always wanted to write a book about Wall Street, that he's been collecting stories over the course of his experience in investment banking. He's worked in New York and Hong Kong and London, and that this isn't a whistleblower account or an assault on a specific firm, Goldman, but it's really a book that's going to be about the true culture mm-hmm. of Wall Street.
So do you have any G-rated tweet favorites you can share with us?
I do. I had to call through quite a few tweets to find some tweets that were fit to print in the New York Times. Some of the tweets about Goldman are really the funniest and the darkest. One of them is, quote, "Getting fired from Goldman is like being traded by the Yankees. You'll probably still make millions, but it's not the same." And there was another one about corporate warfare. Quote, "Only Neanderthals resort to violence. I prefer crushing one's spirit, hope, or ego."
Aw.
Yeah. I'll leave out some of the ones about wives and girlfriends and poor people, but there are plenty.
On a serious side, I would imagine a lot of the information that would be, you know, uttered in the halls of Goldman Sachs is serious, confidential, financial information. Is that in there? Is that in the Twitter feed?
No, not really. And not that I've seen anyway. There are more than 2 years of tweets, so there might be some here and there. But these tweets are submitted to the author of the account anonymously. He has an email address, elevatorgoldman@gmail.com, and collects things. He told me in an email this week that he does do a little bit of editing for clarity, that, you know, he has to kind of tailor them to the audience. So it's certainly a very well-edited Twitter feed, and it's not going to be sharing any kind of insider information. But I think that a lot of it certainly will end up in the book. He did tell me that his favorite tweet was totally unprintable and also obscure.
So is this going to be the collected tweets, or is this a narrative?
It seems like it will be more substantive than just a little gifty book that has a lot of tweets in it. He's going to be discussing the culture of Wall Street. You know, this is something that's certainly getting a lot of time in film and in books, going way back to Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis, which is really the quintessential Wall Street memoir that's sold 2 million copies at this point. And there are a lot of more recent books on Goldman. Greg Smith, who is the Goldman employee, former Goldman employee, who wrote a very widely read op-ed in the New York Times, received a book advance of $1.5 million.
That was why I left Goldman Sachs op-ed.
Exactly. And that was also the title of the book, which was released by Grand Central in 2012.
So, Julie, it used to be that aspiring authors could just set up a blog and get a book deal. I guess now it's from Twitter feed to book deal might be the new path.
From Twitter feed, Tumblrs. I mean, I certainly think that one could accuse the publishing industry of trawling the internet looking for good ideas. And who knows? I mean, I talked to a couple of different publishers who saw this book proposal and passed on it and thought that it wasn't, you know, was mildly amusing, but wouldn't really have a huge audience. Greg Smith's book that was released by Grand Central only sold about 20,000 copies in hardcover, which, considering the amount of publicity that the book got, is a pretty disappointing number. But
how much did this book get?
I don't know. They did not release that information. If anyone knows, email me.
But chances are the person may make more at Goldman Sachs than from the publishing industry.
Yeah, I don't think he's doing this for the money.
All right. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Scott Stossel has a new memoir out, My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Well, that sounds, I guess, nice at the ending at least. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Pamela. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that, because I feel like everybody must say this, but I wonder, am I making you nervous just by holding this conversation?
People do ask me that, but since I'm talking to you from the privacy of a hotel room in remote Los Angeles, I can imagine that it's just the two of us talking rather than hundreds or thousands of people listening on the podcast. So I'm doing mostly fine at the moment.
And do people follow up with, well, what medication are you on in order to ensure that you are feeling calm and at ease?
They often do. And in this case, I am almost pharmacologically naked. I take an antidepressant that is sort of builds up in the system. You can't just stop taking it. But I have not taken additional special measures as I might if this were, in front of an auditorium of, 5,000 people who were looking at me or live TV or something like that.
So here's the obvious question then, which is, given that you do suffer from anxiety, and who doesn't, why write a book about it? Why put it out there?
What precipitated it was when my first book came out about 10 years ago.
This is your biography of Sergeant Shriver.
Biography of Sergeant Shriver, exactly. I was, filled with dread about the prospect of the impending book tour. And so I was already in psychotherapy, but sought out all these other additional measures, going to a psychopharmacologist and a specialist in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a sort of compressed version of exposure therapy that's supposed to help you get over your phobias. And it was while I was going through that, I thought, this is actually, I really ought to think about writing a book about this. And the irony is, of course, I've been succeeded in writing the book, and I'm rewarded 10 years later with another book tour where I have to do all of this stuff. But really what I wanted to do was, I'm fascinated by the topic of anxiety. Freud has this quote where, if we can solve the riddle of anxiety, we'll, unlock a lot of the mysteries of existence. And I do believe that it's not just anxiety, but in my case, that's the thing I happen to be most familiar with. It's a way at looking at both the history of the understanding of the mind and of emotion and at the kind of cutting-edge scientific research on how the brain works, what's the relationship between brain and mind and between molecule and emotion. And so what I try to do in the book is weave together, use myself as kind of the unifying narrative strand, such as it is, to look at various aspects of the history or culture or science or debates over medication, or looked at the other way around. I wanted to consider all of those topics, which can be somewhat abstract and academic, and by infusing the book with my own sometimes, harrowing, sometimes embarrassing, sometimes funny experiences, I thought I could make it more humanizing and give readers someone they could relate to, either as, boy, I know exactly what he's going through and I hope, this provides consolation, or, boy, this guy's crazy, I've never heard of anything like this, but it's still interesting and it's given me a little bit of insight and empathy about how, anxiety is part of the human condition.
One of the things you talk about in the book, one aspect of acute anxiety is, of course, phobia. And you have a number, or have suffered during different periods, from a number of phobias. What are those phobias, and when did you first become aware of them?
Well, the earliest phobia is anxiety called separation anxiety, which is a normal developmental stage in kids. Most 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds, get very anxious when they go off to nursery school for the first time. And at that age, in the right kind of proportion, it is a normal developmental stage. In me, it persisted into first grade, second grade, and all the way into junior high school and high school, to the point where I would wear grooves in the rug of my bedroom because I'd be pacing in circles every night, convinced, utterly convinced in my mind, irrationally, that my parents had died or had abandoned me. It was just this, constant, utter fear of abandonment. And then the first real specific phobia, and for me, the one of longest standing and, most severity and perhaps most idiosyncratically, is emetophobia, which is the pathological fear of vomiting, which I developed at about the age of 7, and which has, as I say in the book, governed my life with a, varying degree of tyranny for the last, 37 years. I have a sort of milder yet equally idiosyncratic phobia of cheese, which is known as turophobia.
I was going to say the first one seems to me most reasonable, but the second one, obviously, more obscure. Do you have any sense of where that comes from?
No, I mean, it could. There's a story from when I was a little kid that those two phobias may relate. I went on a plane flight with my dad and my sister, who's 2 years younger. I was 5 and she was 3, and she picked up a piece of cheese off the airport floor. And my mother, who also is an emetophobe, sort of freaked out about this. This made a big impression on me. And then sure enough, 2 days later, when we came back from Chicago, I watched my sister throw up in the middle of the living room rug. And I think that somehow this may have seared into my brain the link between cheese and vomiting. There's also, sort of aversive qualities that, you know, certain kinds of cheese smell vaguely like vomit. I'm sorry, this is so disgusting. anyway, so that's maybe how those relate. And fascinatingly, my daughter, who I sought to hide my phobia, my emetophobia from, developed it at roughly the same age as I did. She's now 10. And when she was 6, 7, suddenly developed the same severe phobia. And, you know, we had a hard time getting her to go to school. And it was just sort of heartbreaking, but also fascinating that, you know, how could something as idiosyncratic and particular as emetophobia be passed down genetically? Or had I somehow conferred it through to her by unconsciously, you know, modeling that behavior? I mean, I think it's rational to be afraid of vomiting. It's the degree of time thinking about it that is not proportionate to the threat. I mean, I have not actually vomited since 1977, so the amount of time that I think about trying to avoid it, worrying that I might, takes up a lot of brain space that would be better spent doing other things.
Right. It's that opportunity cost, I imagine, that then can in itself become anxiety provoking. But you bring up a larger issue about nurture versus nature. And I imagine that's something that you explore in the book in terms of trying to figure out the source of an individual's anxiety.
That's a really interesting question and something that I spend two long chapters in the book exploring. And actually what I do is I lay out in one chapter on sort of the origins of my separation anxiety, you know, the long history of research going back to Freud and a mid-century British psychoanalyst named John Bowlby, who developed attachment theory, who lay out this incredibly convincing case that one's relative level of anxiety, or your feeling of security in the world as an adult, is powerfully determined by your early relationships with your caregiving figures, most often your mother. And there's tons of evidence to support this. You know, some of it speculative in the Freudian research, but, you know, Bowlby looked at all these people and studied kids in labs and would see how they would react when their mothers left the room. And, you know, he developed a whole typology of different attachment styles, and insecure attachment style was very strongly correlated with a tendency to develop anxiety or depression later in life. And then, you know, there's neuroscience research that shows that mother rats that lick and groom their baby pups more than those who don't, the significantly licked ones actually have lower stress responses. So it's almost like the power of maternal affection is a significant driving force in the level of anxiety you have as an adult. So I sort of conclude provisionally that chapter by saying, well, clearly all this proves that my mother's, you know, super anxious self, she emits sort of almost an audible thrum of anxiety, you know, combined with her rather severe overprotectiveness, was definitely what caused my anxiety. But then in the next chapter, I look at the exploding research on the genetics of anxiety, which is proliferating, you know, by the day. And, you know, my ultimate conclusion is that one's general temperament and one's predisposition to be anxious and to react sort of neurotically or to break down under stress is highly, highly encoded by your genes. You know, your basic genome sort of determines whether you will have a high reactive or a low reactive temperament, as the Harvard psychologist Jerome Kagan puts it. You know, that more than anything determines your baseline level of anxiety. But then that said, I don't want to make it completely deterministic, because,
right,
you know, you can have identical twins, and if one member of the twin set has panic disorder, the other member is much, much, much more likely to have panic disorder than a typical member of the population, but not guaranteed to have it. So there's an interrelation between nature and nurture, and overlaid,
right,
on top of the genetics, there is your upbringing and, you know, whether you've been subjected to trauma, and then the culture that you live in, and luck, and all kinds of other factors as well.
It's interesting when you bring up something like separation anxiety, which for a period of time is normal and expected, and even worrisome if a child between a certain age, you know, certain ages, doesn't go through separation anxiety, then you think that there's not a proper attachment. And it's also, I think, interesting that it's one of those disorders that that there is very little evidence that of separation anxiety among adults, that it's a purely childhood anxiety, and that children who have separation anxiety are then predisposed to other forms of anxiety. Did you look at this whole idea of how anxiety sort of changes over the course of a person's, over a lifespan?
Actually, interestingly, a lot of the research on attachment theory does suggest that, you know, the kids who had insecure attachments with their parents as infants or toddlers or young children does actually translate into a form of, it's not necessarily separation anxiety, but they tend to have more difficulty forming romantic relationships. They're always more jealous. So there's definitely a way where that directly translates. But there's also interesting research led by, among others, Ron Kessler, who's at Harvard Medical School and sort of an epidemiologist who's looked at tons of data about rates of anxiety. And, you know, he talks about why, you know, one reason why if you have kids who seem unduly predisposed to anxiety or distressed by it, it's actually important to get early intervention because you can actually head off what he sees as this trajectory. So, you know, as he puts it, like a 5-year-old kid who has a dog phobia, like that in itself may not be a big deal, especially if there are not dogs around. But a kid with a dog phobia is, you know, X percent more likely than to develop, you know, some form of social phobia as, say, a middle schooler, and subsequently more likely to develop panic disorder as a teenager, and then, you know, far more likely than they ordinarily would be to end up, you know, as he puts it, like drug addicted, you know, just totally dysfunctional as a 25-year-old woman. Now, plenty of kids have phobias of dogs. That does not mean they're likely to grow up to become a 25-year-old drug addict. But there is kind of an unfolding of the disease over the life course. And whereas people tended to see them as discrete things, you know, well, when you're 5, kids tend to be afraid of big animals. When they're in adolescence, they have a lot of social issues. It may be that it's all the same disease kind of just unfolding the way like a cold does. You know, you get a sore throat and then you get stuffed up, and that these are actually all aspects of the same underlying disease, which is often an anxiety disorder or depression or some combination of the two.
Yeah, among those many varieties, you talk about PTSD, generalized anxiety disorder. How discrete are these things, and how much are they sort of part of this one big family of anxiety? And where does it sort of stop being an aspect of normal behavior, because everyone is anxious at some point, and probably justifiably so, into something that becomes then a disorder, dysfunction?
That's a really big, important set of questions, which are not really fully answerable. And the American Psychiatric Association, with its sort of Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, tries to answer the question by actually laying out, you know, in very specific terms, the set of discrete symptoms that each of the, you know, officially classified anxiety disorders, so that's post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder with agoraphobia, specific phobia, social anxiety disorder, and OCD.
When you were writing this book, was there one question that you personally really wanted to get an answer to, and did you answer that question for yourself?
Good question. I don't think there was one single question. I mean, I set out knowing that, and just the nature of my mind is that I was going to be asking a lot of questions that were going to lead to other questions without necessarily determining a single pat answer to any of it. I mean, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I was hoping that I would set out on this book project, work on it for 4 years, and emerge on the other side cured, which would have created a nice dramatic arc.
A nice happy ending.
Exactly. And in the end, I provide sort of a redemptive ending where I kind of come to terms with my anxiety. I'm coming out, as it were. I'm 44 and have hidden this from everyone, you know, actually much more successfully than I realized when, you know, Galleys of the Book started circulating at work, and we published the excerpt. Everyone came in and was sort of saying, you know, do you need a hug? I had no idea.
Scott Stossel in his other life is the editor of The Atlantic, and so probably makes many writers out there quite anxious. Yes, you hit it very well.
One person described me as human Xanax because I sort of can calm people but I think that's partly since I'm always so internally flapped that, you know, in situations that are actually stressful, I just seem normal because it's not any different from what I'm dealing with in the, you know, my own mind at all times. And again, I'm hoping to with the book, you know, I hope lift some of the stigma that attaches to mental illness generally, but in particular to anxiety disorders. And, you know, I am, despite, you know, my struggles with anxiety, despite, you know, the rather large gap between my outward projection of confidence and competence and my inward feelings of anxiety and vulnerability, you know, I have managed to survive and even at times thrive. And so, you know, I hope that provides some consolation or hope to people like me. for anyone who doesn't suffer any anxiety, I think some people have said that they read it and have a much deeper understanding of the role that it plays as as a central component of the human condition.
Well, we'll end on that relatively calm and happy note. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Scott Stossel. His new book is My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, there are a few new titles on the hardcover fiction side of things, starting at number 3 with a book called First Love, written by James Patterson and Emily Raymond. It's not actually the only James Patterson book on the list this week. His latest Alex Cross book, Cross My Heart, is still hanging on there at number 16 after 8 weeks on the list. Then at number 6, there's a new book called The Dead in Their Vaulted Arches by a guy named Alan Bradley. He's a Canadian, a former TV engineer and professor who in his 70s won a crime writing contest for a novel starring an 11-year-old heroine in mid-20th century Britain. Her name is Flavia Deluce. Deluce. She is an amateur chemist and an amateur detective who kind of stumbles across these grotesque, macabre murders and solves them. They're a lot of fun. He's become a big popular writer in his 70s. And now Sam Mendes is turning the books into a BBC miniseries.
I feel like Sam Mendes does a lot of turning things into.
He does, yes.
Didn't he just do a show in the West End? Next.
Next, at number 13, Jennifer Chiaverini has a book called Mrs. Lincoln's Rival. You may remember her. Her most recent bestseller was Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker.
That's right. You need to do, I think, a column at some point about how many books are either the husband's, so-and-so's wife, or Mrs. whatever, and how often they get on the bestseller list.
It's true. In fact, The Husband's Secret is still on the list after 9 weeks. That's Leanne Moriarty's novel about a marriage in trouble when a wife finds out a secret that her husband didn't want her to find out until his death. So, yeah, it's true. There are a lot of these husbands, wives, children.
Mrs. So back to Mrs. Lincoln.
So back to Mrs. Lincoln. This is not part of a series, although it is a follow-up to Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. It just kind of expands the territory of that book and looks at the friendship and rivalry between Mary Todd Lincoln and the Washington hostess, Kate Chase Sprague.
Salmon Chase's daughter?
I don't know.
I think it is. You did not read your Team of Rivals.
I did not. And I bet you're right. Then finally, new on the hardcover fiction list this week at number 14, Ian Rankin has hit the latest book in his John Rebus series, Saints of the Shadow Bible. That's new at number 14. There are two new titles on the hardcover nonfiction list this week. At number 9, Gabriel Sherman's unauthorized biography of Fox News chief Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voice in the Room. That enters the list at number 9. And all the way at the top of the list this week, the Washington memoir Duty by the former Secretary of Defense, Robert M. Gates. That makes its debut at number 1.
And that was our cover review last week.
It was. Thomas Ricks called it probably one of the best Washington memoirs ever.
And obviously, readers listen. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.